Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And if you'd like to be on the program during that hour from 2 to 3, you can do so by calling a number I will give you in just a moment. If you're not familiar with the format of the program, it is entirely caller driven. I am your host, but I do not decide what direction the program will go. The callers do that. If you have a question about Christianity or the Bible or anything related remotely thereunto, if you are not a Christian, would like to tell us why, if you disagree with the host about something, anything, and want to balance comment with your own insights, feel free to give me a call. The toll-free number is 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. And we're going to take our first caller, who is Charlie, calling from, it looks like he may be from UCSC in Santa Cruz. Is that correct? Charlie, welcome to the program. Did I get that right? Are you from UCSC?
You got it right. How you doing?
Good. Good to hear from you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you. I have a question that I'll try to be articulate about.
Okay.
A friend of mine gave me a tape that you had done with a Catholic fellow, I think Stapleton or something like that.
Tim Staples.
Staples, that was it.
Yeah.
And here's the question. And one of the tapes, I didn't listen to all of them, but one you were debating the Catholic belief about the Eucharist. And you had made, I thought, a great point about John chapter 6, verse 63, when after Jesus says numerous times about eating his flesh, that he says, what I'm really saying is that the flesh is of no avail. It's the words that I speak to you that are spirit and life. And that was, I found, a very persuasive argument. My concern and my question is, I think his response was better when he says that three verses later, after Jesus apparently clears this up, the people who were there didn't say, well, okay, I get it now. They left him. And my point is, I was persuaded by his arguments that Jesus was talking literally up until verse 63, and then I was persuaded by your argument that he was talking figuratively based upon what he said in verse 63. Then my pendulum swung back the other way based on verse 66, when after apparently clearing it up to be able to hurt him, who had seen him feed 5,000 the day before, walked away. And I was curious if you could make the pendulum swing back the other way for me.
Well, I don't know if I can or not, but to me, the fact that his it says in verse 66, many of his disciples no longer walked with him and departed from him. To me, that doesn't tell us that it doesn't tell us whether they understood him correctly or not. Many times Jesus spoke in very plain words and was very well understood, and people didn't like what he said and they walked away. So, I mean, having people depart from him was sort of a career with Jesus. he had more people leave him than stay with him. So, and that's not just because they found him difficult to understand. Sometimes they understood him very, very well. Like, you know, when a guy said, I'll follow you wherever you go. And he says, well, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. I mean, that man probably understood very well what Jesus said, and we don't know that he followed him. When he told the rich young ruler to forsake all he has and give to the poor, I think the rich young ruler understood very well what Jesus meant. He left. And so a lot of Jesus' words were offensive. In fact, he even says to his disciples, or to the people in verse 61, does this offend you? And so it seems to me that, you know, the fact that certain people left him at the end of this conversation doesn't, to my mind, have any bearing on whether they understood him correctly or didn't understand him correctly. The question is whether we understand him correctly. And when he said, the flesh profits nothing, but the words I speak to you are spirit and life, and it's the spirit that gives life, I think he gave a reasonably good explanation of his comments. The fact that they left him doesn't mean that they still thought he was talking about physically eating his flesh and drinking his blood. They might have, because like many people who've read John chapter 6, like my friend Tim Staples, the Catholic, he doesn't see Jesus' words that way. So, I mean, if there were people in the crowd like him, they would miss his point there in verse 63. The question is, are we missing it or are we seeing it?
Well, can I say something about that?
Sure.
I hear you, and I'm wanting to see it your way, Steve. I have to be honest, I really am. I don't, though, because to me, the sequence is Jesus says what he says, and I'm oversimplifying here. Jesus says what he says, the crowd says, this is really hard, I don't really get this. And then he says it again, and then they say it's hard, I don't get this. And then the argument is, well, okay, he backs off by verse 63, and he says, no, you're really misunderstanding. What I really meant was this. And then the crowd, who twice has said, I don't really get this, this is very hard for me. They don't go, oh, I get it now, I was mistaken before. They then leave, which means to me, those people heard him literally, rightly or wrongly. They heard him speaking literally. I'm not saying that he was speaking literally. I'm saying verse 66 suggests to me that they heard him literally. And then they left. And if they left, if he's speaking literally and they left, that would be, to me, consistent with Jesus not saying, wait, guys, come back. You're mistaken. Because he was speaking literally, and he knew that they had heard him literally. Now, if they were still mistaken, and they thought he was speaking literally, but by verse 63 he said, no, I'm just speaking figuratively, and then they left, he would know that they're leaving with a mistake. He's speaking figuratively, they think he's speaking literally. He doesn't say, guys, come on back. What about verse 63? I'm just having trouble with this, Steve, and I hope I'm articulating it so you understand where I'm coming from.
Well, yeah, I think Tim made the same point, so I don't have any trouble understanding the argument. I just don't personally agree with the argument. I believe that, I think the argument comes from the assumption that Jesus, you know, really wanted these people to understand no matter what. And I don't think he did. I think that Jesus, throughout his entire ministry, concealed his ideas and his words through parables from the crowds who were not interested in following him. And to his disciples, he explained things privately. I think that there's a number of times in the Gospel of John when he says to his enemies, why can't you understand what I'm saying? Because you can't hear what I'm saying, because you're not my sheep, and so forth. And I think the problem was that they didn't have an attitude of submission to him. And so those who didn't, he did not go out of his way to twist their arms or to give them a third or fourth explanation. If people were not interested in following him, he wasn't very interested in having them follow him. That's what I get from reading his whole life and this passage as well.
Okay. Steve, I appreciate your time. I don't see each way, but I really, really, really appreciate you taking the time to walk me through that.
Well, sure, Charlie. I appreciate your call very much.
You bet. God bless you.
All right. God bless you, too. Sorry I couldn't convince you, because
it's okay.
if you have to go back to the Catholic Church and take the Mass because of my failure, I apologize, but it won't kill you.
Thank you.
All right. God bless you. Bye now.
God bless you.
All right. We're going to have to take another caller. I need to hang up on Charlie there. And we're going to take a call from Rhonda in Eugene, Oregon. And we have some lines open. If you'd like to call in, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Rhonda, thanks for calling. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. My question was about rock music, and I'm a fan of the 1980s heavy metal rock, and I've heard some of the Christian metal, and it sounds just as horrible as the metal of the 90s, like Rammstein and all that, and so what's godly about the Christian, because it sounds just as terrible, and would it be bad just to listen to the regular, like, Rammstein rock?
Well, now, let me see what you're saying here. You like the 80s rock, but you don't like the 90s rock? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and, I have an album of Rammstein, you know, because I liked, like, one song on it.
Okay, well, I've never listened to Rammstein, so I can't really critique it. But I would say that I don't think there's any particular style of music that a Christian is forbidden to listen to.
You know, the one that sounds kind of like, raw, you know, where they do that? You know,
yeah.
Some Christians do that, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, Christians have sought to imitate just about every kind of music that's out there, and I guess some people would question the legitimacy of doing so. I have to say that the music of the 70s is my favorite, because that's when I was growing up. I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, so I like the rock and the oldies from the late 60s and the early 70s. That's my favorite stuff, and I didn't even listen to music during the 80s and 90s, that is secular music, so I don't even know what it's like. But I would say this, some of us who were musicians in that time imitated the style of the popular music in the 70s, and I certainly believe that it was a fruitful thing to do. Now, I may believe that because I like that style, and I don't like the more modern styles. But those who are the children of the later decades might find that the Christian music of that style is somehow, you know, meeting some kind of a need. I don't know. I guess I just don't know very many people who've gotten saved listening to it. Perhaps there's some listeners to our program right now who got saved by listening to that kind of Christian music from the, you know, the heavy metal. I'm afraid I'm not qualified to speak about it. All I can say is there's nothing in the Bible that says that you are not permitted to listen to secular music. But the Bible does say a number of times, Paul says, though all things are lawful for me, he says not all things are edifying, not all things are desirable, not all are expedient. And so if somebody listens to hard rock secular music, I'm not going to judge them, but if they ask my opinion, I'd ask them, well, what's it doing to you? What's it doing to your state of mind? What's it doing to your spirit? Does it draw you nearer to God?
Because like when I was a teenager, me and my friends, we used to listen to like Nirvana, and it would make us really depressed. You know, so I had to stop listening to it. But you know, some of it sounds that way, and you're thinking like, where's Christ in it? Because some of the stuff does make people depressed and kind of moody and. And I just don't see how what's the difference? That's all, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so are you saying that some of the Christian music of that style doesn't have any overt Christian message in it?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, that may be true. That may be true. I haven't listened to it. In which case, obviously the Christian music wouldn't have anything more to commend it than the secular music, unless the Christian music at least avoided certain grungy themes that would be found in the secular version. I mean, sometimes Christian music may just be a sanitized version of the secular stuff, in which case sanitation is better than nothing. But at the same time, I'm afraid I'm just not really familiar with that music. I've never tried to keep up with it. So I would say, instead of saying, well, is it okay to listen to secular music, I would just say, ask God, is this music drawing me nearer to God? Now, you might say, no, it doesn't, but this Christian music of that doesn't either. Well, then maybe you don't need to listen to any of that music. I'm not saying you shouldn't, but there are things you can do with your time and with your mind that would draw you near to God. And I guess what the Christian needs to be asking, you see, here's the deal, Rhonda. We're at war with the enemy of our souls. Uh-huh. And the Bible says the weapons of our warfare are not physical, but they are mighty through God. And the purpose of our warfare and of our weapons is to pull down strongholds and cast down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And Paul says, and this is all in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 4 and 5, he says, and our weapons are to bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So the goal is to have every one of my thoughts doing exactly what pleases Christ. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying Christ wouldn't listen to secular music ever. I don't know if he would have or not. I got a feeling he wouldn't have much interest in it. But I can't say there's no place for secular entertainment in measure in the life of a believer. But I think you just need to monitor your thoughts and see, are all my thoughts being held captive to Christ? Does this music take my mind off of Christ, or does it influence me to think more about Christ?
Yeah, because some of it sounds kind of spooky, like on the dark side, you know, and I heard some of the Christian stuff, and it just sounds so similar. I mean, just take out Jesus and put in Satan, and it just sounds the same. And thanks for taking my call, and God bless you.
Okay, Rhonda. God bless you, too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye now. All right. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're halfway through the program. No, we're not halfway through. I was looking at the clock wrongly. We're not even halfway through the program. And our lines are clear for you right now. If you would like to be on the program, this is a great time to call. You'll get right through. The number is 1-800-438-5090. If you have a question about anything related to Christianity or your Christian life, or about Christian history, Christian apologetics, Christian theology, anything that the Bible might have something to say about or that Christians might be interested in, feel free to give me a call. And that includes you who may not be a Christian yourself. but have questions or objections to the Bible or Christianity, I'd be very happy to talk to you. Give me a call. I'll pay for the call right here. Call 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Bob from Portland, Oregon. Bob, hello.
Hello there, Steve.
How you doing?
You know, you were just talking to him about communion, you know, and whether that's the actual body and the actual blood and the body of Christ in the communion.
Yeah, that was the question that lay behind his comments.
Yeah, and Mark 14:23, it just says, and as they were eating, he took bread, and when he had blessed, he brake it and gave to them, and said, take ye, this is my body. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave to them, and they all drank of it. And he said unto them, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many, out of remission of sins, really, in another place it says. But anyway, and then in 1 Corinthians 11:23-34...
Right, Paul gives the same information.
Bob,
let me ask you this. What is the point you'd like to make about this?
Well,
I mean, we don't need to read more scriptures.
This is my body. Well, here he was standing.
Right.
This is my blood. He was standing there, talking.
Okay, I understand. So your point is that it couldn't be his literal blood because his blood had not been shed yet when he said it.
There, sure.
Yeah.
And then in 1 Corinthians 11:23 it says we are supposed to think about his dying for us on the cross at the time we drink the communion and eat the communion bread, because unless we do that, we're drinking it and eating unworthily.
Yeah. I think that when people say, well, you know, it has to be the literal body and blood of Jesus because Jesus said, this is my body.
Yeah.
And this is my blood. Well, they don't remember that Jesus was simply modifying the normal Passover ritual. The ritual, the Jews in the normal ritual would hold the bread, and they'd say, this is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Well, obviously that bread they were holding in their hand was not literally the bread that their fathers ate in Egypt, and it was not affliction either. But they're basically saying this bread reminds us of it or represents that. Right. And when David said that he desired to drink from the well of Bethlehem, and some of his men broke through the Philistine garrison and got some water from him and brought it back to him, he poured out the water on the ground. He said, "This, how can I drink this water? This is the blood of the men who hazarded their lives." Now, he said, this water is the blood of these men. But, of course, it wasn't. He means it represents them. Mm-hmm. And so it represents their blood. So it was not uncommon, and is not uncommon even now, to speak in this manner. If I point to a picture on my wall and say, this is my third child, this is my fourth child right here, well, that isn't really my third and fourth child. That's just a picture of them. But I say, this is them, because the colored piece of paper on the wall is a representation of them. And you know what I mean when I say it. Bob, I appreciate your call.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, brother. God bless you. Bye now. Okay, we'll talk next to Tyson, who's calling from Corvallis, Oregon. Tyson, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I had a question about liberation theology and some interpretations of what Jesus said.
Okay.
Particularly, you know, with a Roman soldier, an extra mile, or turning the other cheek, actually being like nonviolent resistance and exposing the person for what they are and oppressing you. I wonder if you had any thoughts about that.
Now, did you say you're considering these verses in connection with liberation theology?
Yeah, I think that's what they typically use. And in their interpretations that I had never heard before.
Well, I mean, liberation theology, I don't read liberation theologians, so I can't represent their views entirely. But from what I understand, they believe that the gospel requires that we promote social justice even to the point of encouraging revolution against tyrants. And so liberation theologians, for example, have been involved in a lot of the revolutionary activities down in Latin America and so forth, because they feel that, you know, Jesus came to bring liberty to the captives, and they interpret, you know, the poor and the oppressed who are under oppressive governments as being those that Jesus wants to liberate from that particular oppression. So they, in many cases, they favor handing out guns to these people and having them overthrow their oppressors. That certainly doesn't resemble what Jesus said on this occasion or any other occasion. When Jesus said to turn the other cheek, or to go a second mile, basically, the going the second mile seems to me saying just the opposite of what liberation theologians would say. Because what Jesus is referring to is that the Jews in Jesus' day, where he lived, were oppressed by the Romans who had conquered them about 100 years earlier. And so there were Roman soldiers stationed everywhere in Israel to keep the Jews in submission to the Roman authority. So the Jews themselves were an oppressed people. Now, the Roman authority had made laws, one of which was that a Roman soldier could take any citizen, any bystander on the street, and compel that man to carry the Roman soldier's gear for 1 mile. And after that, if he had to go further, he could compel a different citizen to carry it another mile. But there was, the law required a Jew to carry the Roman soldier's gear for a mile, but no further. And Jesus said, well, if someone compels you to go a mile with him, go two. Save him the trouble of finding another guy to do it for him. Just give him more than what he's asking for. Now, this is the opposite of revolution. This is the opposite of overthrowing the oppressors. This is winning over your oppressors with love and with kindness. And I don't really, again, I haven't read the liberation theologians, but I've read bits and pieces of their theology, and it sounds like kind of they're advocating the opposite of that.
Okay. Well, they interpret that passage as actually getting the Roman soldier in trouble, and I've never heard that interpretation before.
Oh, boy. Getting the Roman soldier in trouble, so that if you go two with him, then somehow he'll get in trouble because he only had the right to take you 1 mile. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah.
Well, I think they're grasping at straws there. That example that Jesus gave is one of four examples in rapid succession, and the principle he states at the beginning, of course, that's in Matthew chapter 5. I forget what verse number, but 40 something, I think it is, or late 30s. Jesus said, do not resist the evil man. And then he gives examples of this non-resistance. It begins in verse 38. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. How's that going to get anyone in trouble? If anyone wants to sue you and to take away your tunic, give him your cloak also. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too, and give to him whoever asks you. Mm-hmm. And whoever wants to borrow, don't turn away from it. So Jesus is basically saying, be kind to everybody, including people who are unkind to you, who strike you, who are your oppressors. He's, where is the idea here of get your enemies in trouble this way? I don't see it in these illustrations at all.
Yeah, I guess, they have reason for every one of those, including, like, striking your cheek culturally. I don't know, they have it down to a T, like, you have to do it with your backhand, and so if you turn your cheek, you're exposing them for being over you and oppressing you, and, giving you a cloak also, it's a shameful thing to have someone naked in the streets, and I don't know, things like that. I was just wondering.
I think that's grasping at straws.
Okay.
And missing Jesus' main point.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Tyson, God bless you.
Hey, you too, bud.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye now. All right, we have a line or two open for you. We need to hang up Tyson's phone there. There we go. We got a couple lines open. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. You can call with any question you have about the Bible, or you can call to disagree with the host about something you've already heard here. Give me a call, 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is John, calling from Portland, Oregon. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I told you I'd call you back.
Yes, and I figured I could count on you for that.
Is it okay if we talk on the same subject?
If we cover some new ground, okay?
Well,
in other words, I don't just want to have the same conversation we've had, you know, 6 or 8 times. If you want to cover some new ground on the same subject, that's fine with me.
Well, here's the thing. I have my notes in front of me, so I can...
Good. That'll help.
But I'm still on a cursory phone, so it might be short. Anyway, you know, it says that despise not prophesying, but prove
yes.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really like people to do, because if they do that, then they'll see. It's like the brilliant, you know. They are more noble, and so they look these things up to see if they were so. And so what I'm going to try to say, show you is, you know, give you all the evidence, all the passages that are parallel and that correlate. But not only do they correlate, but they also synchronize. And so that's a dual confirmation. But, you know, Daniel.
Okay, before you start doing that, let me just remind you that you've told me before that Daniel chapter 11 correlates with Matthew 24.
Right.
And all I asked you to do on that occasion, but you didn't do it, was to show me some points of correlation, and you didn't. Now, maybe you can do that now.
I have my notes in front of me now. The other thing is, you know, it says that I was reading one of the church leaders, the church theologians, and in his introduction to one of his treatises, he says that you had to be careful not to share these things. It's a common danger to share these things indiscriminately.
What theologian was this?
It was Hippolytus.
Okay, and Hippolytus did not think that you should share, what, the fulfillment of prophecy widely?
Certain things of prophecy indiscriminately. And it's interesting, I found... Because I looked on the internet one time, and this guy says, "Does anybody know where the gap theory came from?" You know, and I didn't know myself, and we're looking, and so finally, that's where it comes from. And so this idea that a classic premillennialism is something that the early church didn't teach just isn't so.
Oh wait, the early church did teach classic premillennialism. They didn't teach dispensational premillennialism.
Right. Well, like I said before, I'm not dispensational. Also, you asked me, so what you said, you don't know where I disagree with dispensations. Well, one of the places is that the idea that there's a gap between 35 and verse 35 and 36 in Daniel chapter 11. The gap is actually between 20 and 21, because Daniel 21 through 12:2. Covers the 70th week, and right in the middle of it, at verse 31, is where the daily sacrifice is taken away, just like it says will happen in Daniel chapter 9:27.
But you're not seeing Antiochus Epiphanes in this passage then?
No, because you know if it was Antiochus Epiphanes and he set up the abomination desolation, then the great tribulation, the greatest tribulation of all time, should immediately follow, just like it does in Daniel chapter 11. You see?
Well, there's another possibility. There's another possibility, and that is that there's more than one abomination of desolation. One that was set up by Antiochus Epiphanes, spoken of in Daniel 11, and another set up by Titus in 70 A.D. that Jesus predicted.
Well, if it happened at Titus 70 A.D., then why didn't Jesus come? Because Jesus said immediately after the tribulation of those times, you see the sign of the Son of Man coming.
He didn't say he'd come immediately after the abomination of desolation. He said immediately after the tribulation of those days.
The abomination of desolation happens just, but that's what brings the great tribulation on, is he sets up.
Okay.
And that's exactly
okay.
what
Okay, let's accept that. Let's accept that for the point of argument, okay?
Okay.
Let's say you're right. The abomination of desolation begins the great tribulation.
Uh-huh.
And Jesus returns at the end of the Great Tribulation. Okay, I'm not saying that's my view, but let's accept that.
That's what Jesus said in Matthew 24. It's exactly what he said.
That's not exactly what he said. And it's, are you unaware of the apocalyptic language that the prophets used that resembles what Jesus said there? When he talked about the sun and the moon being darkened and the stars falling from the sky? I mean, that's something that is a reference to the fall of a kingdom. It's not really referring to the fall of the universe or solar system, as it sounds like it is. These are things that the Old Testament prophets said all the time when they were talking about the fall of Babylon or the fall of Egypt or the fall of some other earthly power. It's poetic language. It's called apocalyptic language, and Jesus used it. And I believe he was talking about the fall of Jerusalem. But what I'm saying is this. I'm doing you a favor. John, I'm doing you a favor. I'm not disputing. I'm not disputing with you. I don't believe, but I'm not disputing. I'm going to accept for the sake of argument your point that the abomination of desolation begins the Great Tribulation, and the second coming of Christ is at the end of it, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the question is, how long is that Great Tribulation?
The Great Tribulation, well, it'll probably be about 40 days minus one.
And where would we get that? Not from Jesus, or not from the book of Revelation?
We do get it from Jesus. Jesus said that the end days would be just as it was in the time of Noah. How long did it rain? 40 days.
But he didn't say the Great Tribulation would last as long as the flood of Noah. He said it was as in the days of Noah before the flood, that they were eating, drinking, and giving in marriage. He said, that's the way it'll be. He said, and the flood came and took them all away, so shall it be in the coming of the Son of Man. He didn't say that the length of time that the flood lasted would be the same as the length of the tribulation. There's not even anything hinted about that in Jesus' statement.
Well, there's a lot hid, I have to admit.
The trouble is, if things are hidden, in order for us to know them, they have to be brought out by somebody authoritative.
At the end time.
The disciples believed they were living in the end time.
Well,
and they brought out the meaning of the Old Testament prophets.
I think you asked me, why is it important? And that's exactly why it's important, because when some people are able to, when the wise are instructing, then what happens is, and I'm saying this as much to you as I am to your listeners, what happens, you ask, why is it important? Because when you see that sign, when it's unsealed, and we... Because Schofield said in his notes on Revelation, he said that that's what would happen, that these things that are designedly obscure would become more and more clear as the time draws near.
And you agree with Schofield?
On that point, yeah. Because,
he was dispensationalist.
Said to Daniel.
Well, yeah?
Gabriel told Daniel that, these things just seal them up because it's for the time of the end. And so when the end comes, then these things will be unsealed.
Well, the time of the end, you see, you and I have a different view about the time of the end. You believe it's the end of the world. I believe it's the end of the Jewish order in A.D. 70.
Well, I believe it's the end of the age, because then it has to be the millennium, of course.
Right, so the end of the Jewish age. Well, listen, you and I have so many points where we don't connect. Maybe we should just find one point that really matters and connect on that. Like, the one I always bring up, and this is the only thing that irritates me sometimes about our conversations, is because after I've talked to you a long time, I still don't know what in the world it matters. Now, it sounds to me like what you're saying, you say it matters because of the following. Let me see if I'm representing your view correctly. That Daniel predicts that in the end times, the wise will understand, and those who know their God will be strong and do valiantly, do exploits. And those who are wise will instruct many, okay? And therefore, since you think that's talking about our present time, and that you are one of those wise people that people need to be listening to, that if we don't listen to you, we will miss out on something. Is that correct?
Well, there will be scoffers. Of course, the scoffers will miss out.
Now, did I represent your view correctly is what I want to know.
Yeah, you do.
Okay, so now here's my response to that. Joseph Smith said the same thing when he started the Mormon Church. He said that he was one of the wise, speaking in the last days, restoring the truth. Why should I believe you're one of the wise men and not believe that he's one of them?
Okay, here's my answer. You know, the Bereans were more noble, and so they looked to see if these things were so. And that's what I want to do. What I want to do is I want to give to you and your listeners the parallel passages, and if you just take the notes down, take the parallel passages, and what you can do is just check for yourself, and the evidence is there if you have eyes to see.
Okay. Now, right? I'm sitting at a table with a Bible open in front of you. Many of my listeners are driving in cars and doing things. They can't check a lot of details here. Could you give us the Reader's Digest version and just say, okay,
sure.
Here's the things that I see in Daniel 11. Don't even give me the verse numbers. Just list them for me rapidly and say, and I see the same things in Matthew 24. And
I can give it to you by chapter. Revelation chapter 6, the whole chapter, basically. Joel chapter 3, basically the whole chapter. And 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, basically the whole chapter. Matthew chapter 24, basically the whole chapter. And Daniel, but not the whole chapter. And Daniel starts at Daniel 11, verse 21.
Okay, but that's too much of a Reader's Digest version because you haven't told us anything. You just gave us some numbers. What I want to know, tell me, like right now, give me three things that are in Daniel chapter 11 that are also in Matthew 24.
All right, I will. All right, and I'll correlate them for you. Okay.
Just tell me what they are. Just name them. Three things.
All right, three things. The Antichrist arising, the beginning of sorrows, the great apostasy, and the Great Commission fulfilled.
Okay, now, I do believe that most of those things are mentioned in Daniel 24, Matthew 24. What verses do you find them in Daniel 11? Where's the Antichrist there?
The Antichrist is in verse 21, 22, and 23. The beginning of sorrows is in 25 and 26. The great apostasy, the great apostasy is in verse 30 through 32. And the Great Commission is in 33, 34, 35.
Okay. Well, I don't see any of those words in there, but some of those concepts may be there. There is reference to people, apostatizing, but that there's plenty of times in history that good people have apostatized. You know, every scholar in the world.
So, Steve, then you're saying that all this synchronizing and all this correlating.
It isn't. There's no mention of Antichrist in this passage. There's no mention of a beginning of sorrows in this passage. Okay,
you're saying it's found in those verses.
I looked at those verses.
Steve, you're saying that God has to make it all. You know, in other words, it can't be hidden. That's what you're saying. You're saying nothing, none of this can be hidden.
You know what? If it's hidden, we can't see it. But you see, what I'm saying is, let me tell you something, John. John, let me tell you something.
Jesus' disciples came to him. Why do you speak to him in parables? It's because his view is given, but to them is not given. Given because seeing they perceive not is a fulfillment of exactly what Isaiah said.
All right. So the people who were under God's judgment couldn't see it, and the people who were disciples could. Am I under God's judgment or am I a disciple?
Well, Steve, you're still living. So it says that God gives grace to the humble, in other words, teachable, but to the pride He doesn't. So.
Okay, so you have evidence that I'm proud then, and that you're not.
Well, if I try to share something with you, and I ask you, it reminds me of that is it Nahum, the guy who was asked to go and dip into the river to be healed, and he said we have rivers in his homeland. Why does he have to go to the Jordan dip in? But it's a simple thing for him to do. And he, of course,
the principal difference is. John, the principal difference is that Naaman was told by a prophet of God to do it. Are you a prophet of God? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, I told you the first time I called you that I had the gift of prophecy.
You have the gift of prophecy, okay. So you're like Elisha, and I should take your word as the word of God because it comes out of your mouth.
Well, I admit I've had many revelations, and I prayed for angelic visitation, and after I prayed for an angelic visitation, I received a very bad dream, but it was about the end of the world. But it was not, again, I don't think, angelic visitation. But I could have one from Gabriel, and of course, then he might tell me who I am. But right now, I'm still not sure.
John, how long have you been a Christian? I'm just curious.
Not quite as long as you have.
I just wonder. I'm not trying to compare. I'm not comparing ages. I'm just wondering how long have you been a Christian? Because you come off as a very naive young Christian. Are you?
No.
Okay. Could you give me you've been saved for more than
you
5 years?
Naive, and I come across naive. But your hermeneutic is kind of it's not very rigorous.
Okay, what I'm saying is this. I'm not trying to sound as condescending as I probably do sound. I'm truly not trying to. I'm trying to ascertain whether you're just a very naive young Christian or whether you're an old Christian who really has never gotten to a place of discerning between truth and error. You seem to feel, and I can, when I was a young Christian, I felt this sometimes too.
Are you interested in hearing my testimony?
Not the whole thing. No, you've already taken more time than anyone else has on this program today. But I am interested in knowing why it is although I don't know if you can give me a good answer or not, or if you will, but why it is I should believe anything you say, since you're claiming you got it by divine revelation. And I've had people tell me, all my life I've had people tell me that they've gotten things by divine revelation, and most of them were flaky. Why should I believe that you're an exception?
That just makes my job more difficult. But listen, Steve, I told you before, all you got to do is take these passages that I've given you, all of them, and see that they all correlate, and they're all talking about Daniel's 70th week. It all fits. And, you know, I used to have this paradigm. I used to have this Seventh-day Adventist paradigm, and I used to think that there was no gap between Daniel.
Okay, so did you come out of Seventh-day Adventist background?
No. I mean, I was into Seventh-day Adventism for a time until I found out that they believed that the millennial reign is going to be in heaven. Well, that's basically amillennialism.
Yeah, see, they believe Ellen G. White received insights into prophecy that were kind of by revelation, too, and it's kind of a mindset, I guess, that I don't have, frankly, I don't have as much respect for as perhaps you want me to. I'm looking for someone who can show me that the scriptures really say something.
You're misunderstanding me. I didn't say that I was coming from, I don't believe in a Seventh-day Adventist. In fact,
I know, but the point is.
That was when I had a break with them.
Okay, well, John, let me tell you what I'm thinking. You just gave me a list of scriptures. Revelation 6. 2 Thessalonians 2, as I recall, Matthew 24, Daniel 11. All of those passages, except for Daniel 11, I have memorized. And so you're asking me to set them side by side and look at them. I can look at them in my head. I can run through what they contain. I know what's in there. Okay? I don't see the parallels you're seeing. All right? So now, let me say this. There could easily be things I don't see because they have to be seen by wiser men than me, by people who have more spiritual insight, more spiritual revelation. I wouldn't rule that out because I don't claim to be a prophet. I don't claim to have special revelations. And there are, you know, perhaps some people will see things I won't. But if they want to show them to me, and if they want me to understand that they're correct, they're going to have to show me that that matches up with what I know the Bible actually says.
Moses said that he would that all God's people would be prophets. Have you ever prayed for the gift of prophecy?
Of course, the Bible tells us to. The Bible tells us to covet to prophesy. I pray for prophecy, but not all prophecy appears in the same way, and it's not all revelations about hidden meanings.
You said one time to someone who called you that you'd fasted for, I think, a week or 3 days.
You must have been listening. I have never been on a long fast. The longest I've ever fasted was 3 days. That's not very long.
Yeah, that's not very long. So if you want to get the prophecy, I would recommend fasting longer than 3 days.
Well, the Bible doesn't say I have to fast for the gift of prophecy, so I'll do that if the Spirit leads me, and not because you've said so, John. But, John, my concern here is that you are introducing entirely subjective interpretations of passages of Scripture, and you're asking me to believe them and my listeners to believe them on the basis that you think you're a prophet.
It says, despise not prophesying, but prove them. And I've given the passages, but the thing is, you can't just rely on your memory.
Why not?
What you do is put them side by side and look at them, and all that correlation.
Okay, I don't know why I can't rely on my memory. I can tell you, I can go passage by passage and tell you what's in each of those in those verses. I can also tell you that while I have not memorized Daniel chapter 11, I have studied it and taught it many times, and I happen to know that the part that you're applying to the Antichrist correlates point by point with history and Antiochus Epiphanes. And that's why every scholar on the planet applies it that way.
If it was Antiochus Epiphanes, then the Great Tribulation would have followed as soon as he put up the abomination.
You've already given me that argument, and I gave you a counter-argument. If you don't like my counter-argument, you don't have to.
Your only argument was that chapter 12 heading went in between the Great Tribulation and the abomination.
No, that's not true. What I said was there's more than one.
That's not
John.
Anyway,
John, we're going to
put in there.
Okay, John, we're done. We're done. Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
Goodbye. Just so you remember, John, what I said is there's more than one abomination of desolation. There's one that's mentioned in Daniel 11, which was Antiochus Epiphanes. Every scholar in the world, as far as I know, whether they are dispensationalists or amillennial, it doesn't matter what their viewpoint is, they all recognize that in that section of Daniel 11, it is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, some dispensationalists say, and that Antiochus Epiphanes was a type and a shadow of the future Antichrist. So they sometimes tried to take some of those verses and apply them additionally to a future Antichrist. But they admit, as everyone must who knows anything about the history, that those verses were fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes in 168 BC. And therefore, when it says that he will set up an abomination that causes desolation, it happened in 168 BC. And if you say it isn't true, then you disagree with everybody who's ever studied the historical material that Daniel's predicting. And I don't really think you've got that much authority, so I'm sorry if I'm unconvinced. Get yourself a radio show, and you can teach that all day long if you'd like. It costs you a lot of money, though. Okay, let's talk to Charles from Cheed, Oregon next. Charles, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah, that's Chad.
Chad. Okay, it's spelled wrong on my screen. That's okay.
I read in a book here where a guy makes a connection between Herod and the message he got from the wise man that troubled him, and he goes forth with great fury and kills the babies.
Yeah?
He ties that in with Daniel 11:44.
11:44.
Yeah, and tidings out of the east, and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and early to take away many. It sounds like the same person.
Well, I'll tell you what, you've got a better point than John had. Because there really is there in Daniel 11:44 a possible parallel with Herod. And there's a number of responsible scholars who think that the king in that section of Daniel 11 is Herod.
Yeah, well, that's the first I'd ever run into it.
And, yeah, it's a good point.
I never heard it.
I myself think that the king in verse 36 through 45 of Daniel 11 is the Roman Empire. And, of course, Herod was part of that. So that statement could indeed be about Herod.
Okay.
And it could, you know, so some people think it's Rome. Some people think it's the Muslims. Some people think it's Herod. There's a lot of different views about who that king is. And my personal view is it's referring to the Roman Empire coming and conquering Israel. And, of course, the first king that they set up was Herod. And he killed those babies, and so it's a good point you make,
yeah.
I think,
at least
possible.
Okay, that's all I need to know.
Okay, well, Charles, I appreciate your call.
All right, bye.
God bless you. Bye-bye now. You didn't expect me to agree so quickly, huh? Okay, well, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and if you'd like to be on, we have a few minutes only left, about 5 minutes. So you can be our last caller of the day if you jump right in. 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. I want to remind you about our website. I don't really mention it that often on the air because usually the calls are so numerous I don't get around to it. And I have a hard time remembering to stick in plugs for different things we have to offer when there's callers waiting. I don't like to keep them waiting. But our website has a lot of resources, and they're all free. We're not selling anything. This is not a commercial. We have nothing for sale. It's all free. There's 900, approximately, MP3 files of lectures, verse by verse through every book of the Bible, including Daniel, including Matthew 24, including 2 Thessalonians, including Revelation, and all the rest. And there's also several hundred topical lectures on virtually everything under the sun. And those are free at our website. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Our next caller is Kit, calling from Marina, California. Kit, welcome to the... I think I may have just accidentally... Oh, there we go. Are you there, Kit?
Yeah, I'm there.
Oh, good.
Okay. A caller called in a little while ago and was talking about liberation theology. And I've never heard of that term before, but I believe that this is the theology that my professor subscribes to. I'm a student at UC Santa Cruz, and I'm taking a class called... Early Christianity.
Yeah.
And I'm only a week into the course, and I've noticed that so far he has turned Jesus' entire message into a political one, to where all the parables were meant to convey a message of how to basically be more financially well off, how to restore Israel to political power. In fact, he even goes so far as to say that Jesus' whole mission was to see Israel, national Israel, restored, and to see, you know, his countrymen kick out the Romans and, you know, restore to justice, basically. And I thought, that's not really how I read it. I think it's more of a spiritual, you know. I even told him that the kingdom of heaven, he said, is not of this world. And he is a king, but not of this world. he commented back saying that, well, that's John's words that he added in there. It's funny how we don't see that in the gospel. And he said, well, how do we know that conversation actually took place between him and Pilate? Who was there to record it? And so I just want to get your opinion on some of that.
Yeah, well, if we don't know what Jesus said because it's recorded in the Gospels, then we don't know what Jesus said about anything.
Yeah.
I mean, how does he know Jesus taught liberation? How does he know he taught that Jesus taught revolution? If we don't trust the Gospel records, we don't have record of anything Jesus ever spoke.
Mm-hmm.
Except, well, we do have quotations of Jesus from the church fathers, but they got them from the Gospels. So, I mean, I really think your professor's on thin ice. Of course, he probably doesn't respect any of the Gospels, and he probably doesn't even care whether his view is correct or not. I think what he wants to do, liberation theology is basically Marxism dressed up in Christian proof texts, but they're not very well understood Christian proof texts. But basically the idea is if there's any oppressive power, and the common man, the proletariat, is trodden underfoot, well, then Jesus wants to encourage them to rise up and be liberated through revolution. That's liberation theology as I've heard it presented and as I think of it. So it sounds just like the kind of stuff that someone at UCSC would teach. And so, I guess you probably have encountered liberation theology after all.
Yeah. All his parables, I mean, many of his parables start off by saying the kingdom of God is like, and then, you know, blah, blah, blah. He, though, the professor, will say that he was trying to tell his listeners that, you know, in this story, there is a, you know, corrupt leader representing the, Herod and Titus, or the Roman overseers, overlords, and, you know, the victim in the story were the oppressive peasants, and, you know, so there was no spiritual message being conveyed there. It was all basically making them realize their situation and how to interpret their situation as not being an act of God, like being punished or anything, but it was more of just being oppressed by foreign rulers. And this is whole Jesus' mission.
The problem with this is it makes Jesus out to be the revolutionary trying to whip up the masses. In reality, it was the masses that were revolutionary, and Jesus tried to calm them down. Remember in John chapter 6, verse 15, it says when Jesus saw that the multitude was about ready to take him by force and make him king, he sent them away and withdrew because he didn't want them to do that. There was a time when somebody came to Jesus and reported an atrocity that Pilate, a Roman, had committed against Galileans in Luke chapter 13, the very beginning. And Jesus said, do you think these Galileans were worse sinners than others? Unless you repent, you'll all likewise perish. But the point is, he indicated that they need to repent. They don't need to revolt. And yet that was in a context where someone told him of a terrible atrocity that the oppressor Pilate had committed. Jesus could have said, you need to revolt or you'll likewise perish. He said, no, you need to repent or you'll likewise perish, because their nation was under judgment from God. And that's what Jesus taught them, that they should be prepared for that judgment and they need to come out and follow him instead, but not in a revolution against the government. Listen, I'm out of time here. I appreciate your call, though, bro.
Yeah, I'll call back next week about something else related to this. I don't have enough time for it, though, but
all
appreciate
right.
Your opinion.
Thanks. God bless
Thank you.
Thank
you. Take care. God bless you.
Bye-bye now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. You never know what you'll hear here, because I don't ever know what you're going to hear here. I don't know what I'm going to hear, because people call in, and we find out as it happens. It's just like real life, isn't it? If you'd like to keep this real life type program on the air live, then you can help us by helping us pay our bills. You can find our address at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. That's www.thenarrowpath.com. This is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. Till then, may God bless you. Bye now. Get out of